Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 291. What are the current techniques being employed to improve the performance of LLM-based systems? How is the industry shifting from post-training towards context engineering and multi-agent orchestration? This week on the show, Jody Burchell, data scientist and Python advocacy team lead at JetBrains, returns to discuss the current AI coding landscape. In our last conversation, Jody covered how LLMs were approaching the limits of scaling laws. This time, we'll recap last year's big focus on reasoning models and a post-training method called reinforcement learning from verifiable rewards. We also cover test time compute, where models spend more time reasoning through steps and considering multiple approaches to solve a problem. We touch on agent context protocol, agent orchestration layers, and context engineering. We also share some concerns about the hype cycle, maintaining all that code being generated, and running local models. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Jody. Welcome back.
Hi, it's been a little while, about six months, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a regular time to check in.
Yes. A few things have changed.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it has been quite a busy 6 months as far as LLMs and the whole agentic thing has kind of taken off. And I thought we could come in and talk a little bit about sort of the state of things. And you've had a couple of interesting talks recently. You were doing some stuff for the JetBrains channel, if people are interested in. You did a really kind of cool AI agent course, and it's much more geared toward language stuff, but I think that's actually a really useful example in this. But you're kind of building this language learning agent, language learning like you're trying to learn a foreign language.
Yes.
In some ways, but you're tying together LangGraph and Olama and MCP and some other stuff. It's a neat course. It's pretty chunky.
Oh, yeah. It took me quite a long time.
Yeah. I think people might enjoy that. So I'll have a link for that. We have a bunch of resources we'll be referring to this week. But yeah, I wanted to kind of get an idea of, you know, where you think things are. Our last conversation, we talked a little bit about sort of the limits of where LLMs were at. And I think that's kind of what happened for the next 6 months here is like, well, if we're at our limit, maybe we should try some new things.
Yes. So in the last episode that I was on, what we kind of talked about was this concept of the scaling laws.
Yeah.
So scaling laws, you should go and listen to the episode. It's nice, but just a recap.
Yeah. Lots of research and stuff in there. Yeah.
Lots. Yes. Once an academic, always an academic. So basically, there was this idea that we train LLMs on huge corpora of language, and we make them really, really big, and they will just keep getting better and better. And it was pretty obvious by mid-late 2024, and then obviously 2025, that wasn't the case. And so the model creators turned to various post-training techniques. These are things that you do after you train this initial model to make it better at doing certain things.
Yeah.
So the kind of really exciting thing to come out of post-training was a type of model called a reasoning LLM. And these are LLMs that are specialized to sort of decompose complex problems and solve the component parts. And the way that you used to make these reasoning models, or the way you do make these reasoning models, it's not an obsolete technique, but it used to be that you entirely had to make these handcrafted data sets that showed the models how to do problem solving.
Kind of like as kids, we would get shown a bunch of logic problems.
Yeah.
And work through them in a grade school situation. I don't know if they still do that, but
I think they do. And it's actually interesting because one of the like examples that I saw was for Quen 3, and it was trained explicitly with these sort of problems. And it's exactly those sort of problems. Like you have like five, I don't know, apples, and I don't know, Ali has 10 apples. How many apples do you have? This sort of stuff. Right. And you sort of show the model how to break that down and work out how to solve it.
Or the relationships between all these different people. And
Yeah, exactly. So these sort of data sets are obviously really, really expensive and difficult to make. So while they perform well, it is quite difficult to scale them. So a new technique, it's not like from 2025, but it started being used very, very heavily from 2025 onwards, was something called reinforcement learning from verifiable rewards. Basically, what this means is you get data sets in domains that allow you to have problems that have a concrete answer, things like math, things like coding, and you just show the solution and you show the problem and you get the LLM to work out how to solve it. This is kind of a really hot new area because it has the potential to sort of scale a lot better. You can make much bigger data sets and the models can essentially learn from it without being explicitly shown how to do it. So it's much cheaper to make these data sets.
So if we were to make a coding specific one, which there are a whole subset of them, you could start with like the base part of the language and then expand to like existing projects or libraries or other things and kind of like grow its knowledge in that domain.
Exactly. So it does very explicitly have to not be a fuzzy answer. It does have to concretely be like, if you have this particular code, what will it output? But, or like you have this math problem, what will the answer be?
Yeah.
But you can kind of see that like this is a lot easier than hand making data sets that show LLMs how to solve problems.
Yeah.
So the interesting thing is like the state of things so far is that this technique is rarely kind of used by itself. The models that are trained off the back of it aren't necessarily like the state of the art models that are outperforming everything, but it's a technique that has a lot of room to grow and potentially grow into non-math, non-coding domains, which might expand the sort of capabilities for reasoning that LLMs have. This is sort of seen as one of the big things that happened last year. And then that's coupled with something called test time compute. So test time compute is basically you have an LLM, you give it a complex problem, and it can kind of sit and go through various potential solutions until it decides, you know, I always do this, anthropomorphize them, but until it arrives at what it considers an optimal solution based on its training.
Okay. It scores it in a way?
It has internal reward mechanisms, and it basically is like, this one will be maximally satisfying this constraint.
It ticks these boxes, and therefore, boom.
It ticks these boxes. So if you've been wondering why LLMs are chewing through so many tokens, test time compute is one reason for that, because instead of just spitting out one thing, it's internally consuming a bunch of tokens and then, you know, only maybe showing you part of what it's actually used.
Okay.
So we have nice reasoning models now. We have potential direction for them to grow. And what that means is 2025 was the year of agents because reasoning models act as sort of the inference engine inside an agent. And all an agent is, although you should go and watch my course, as Chris said, is really just an LLM working in a type of loop where it can reflect and observe the outputs of each sort of cycle and potentially use tools in order to achieve goals. And these tools generally tend to be things that are good at doing the stuff that LLMs are bad at, like math or interfacing with very specific applications, you know, with structured text or structured instruction sets.
Okay.
Yeah, basically, this is sort of why we've ended up where we've ended up in 2025. And yeah, it's kind of been a little bit exciting, but I think also very overwhelming.
Yeah, it's kind of like in the world of data, going back to my computer background of the 80s and 90s and stuff like that, there were interfaces that were serial and parallel. You know, mm-hmm. the idea of parallel is really not common today as far as a connection of sending data, probably because of just, you know, data quality issues and stuff like that, and making sure that, you know, you couldn't do long lines. But there used to be a thing called SCSI, S-C-S-I.
I think I've heard of that, actually. Or maybe, no, I've seen it when my old computers were starting up, yeah. I think. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that was the way you would connect like a hard drive or whatever. And they had to be like short cables and terminators and all this kind of fancy stuff. And then everything kind of got moved with, especially USB, to like serial, this one direction, or, you know, this one channel. And I feel like LLMs were very, very singularly channeled for such a yeah. long time now. And now they've kind of done this thing where they're like kind of parallelizing the work. I mean, the same thing happened with CPUs, right? Where we kind of started hitting the Moore's law, kind of like, well, you know, things are getting too hot. Stuff needs to either get smaller or get rid of the heat or whatever, or we could have multiple things doing the work. And in this case, like being able to split up the work to be able to find components that could do the specializations. And I think that kind of gets us into, like, especially with agents, you know, I've had a lot of conversations. I think about the two things you're talking about, they've had different names. Spec-driven development being this idea of like having text files or markdown files. Skills is the latest name for these things, mm-hmm. where we've gotten a set of instructions about this is how we should do this and so forth. Pay attention to this. Mm-hmm. I mean, it could be also the whatever the statement is at the beginning of your prompt that says, you know, how I want this to run and so forth. I saw somebody today was just super mad, like, never do an inline import in any of my stuff.
In
my Python code. And I was like, okay, yeah, I guess if you're seeing it do that, but it's like suddenly like, oh, I need this now. And it just like sticks an import mm-hmm. in the middle of your code. I could see how that's kind of frustrating yeah. for a lot of people, and not, you know, it's like follow PEP8. But anyway, there's that kind of like documentation / rules, even code, right? That skills can even have like code within them mm-hmm. for how to do specific things. And then on the other side of that, you have MCP, mm-hmm. which is kind of related, but in an idea that I want to talk to this other system and I need to give it a set of rules. And I jokingly have used this analogy of like, it's like the Matrix, like, oh, I want to learn how to do this thing. It's like, download
oh,
it.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now I know how to do Kung Fu. Now I know how to do... Yeah. You know, whatever, Grubhub or something.
I can shop for you online.
Exactly. Ooh. Yeah, totally. So anyway, that's kind of in the weird, not weird, but interesting path that we've gone through. And we're still sort of wading through a lot of this additional information, you know, where it was more of this one-on-one kind of thing with an LLM. It was like all chat, like mm-hmm. really right up to 2025. And then almost all of 2025 has been like, maybe there's something else here. Mm-hmm. Is that a good way to think of it?
Yeah. What's kind of interesting though is like even RAG, which feels like an old idea now.
Yeah, yeah.
It was essentially kind of a simple agentic system. Maybe not, like, because it didn't really have the cycle, but this idea of like plugging in external capabilities is quite an early design. I think function calling was the first thing, and that was like OpenAI mid 2024, maybe.
Okay.
So we've recognized for a while that LLMs do tend to hallucinate a lot more when you try to get them to do things that they're not able to do. They're language models.
Right.
But yeah, and MCP kind of fits into the tool kind of
architecture.
Yeah, because it's really just a way of standardizing how the LLMs communicate with external things. And like an MCP server is just a fancy name for anything really that communicates via MCP. So
right.
like it can be, you know, the Grubhub API if you want to use that right. and have it buy 25 hamburgers for you.
Yeah. One of the things that you kind of focused on with a lot of the things you're talking about with this idea of the benchmarks are sort of shifting, right? Mm. And so we sort of have to start to kind of look at, you know, that I think was one of the things that you focused on in our last talk is like, well, who's writing these benchmarks and who's, you know, who's creating the tests and then, you know, what's in the test? And there was interesting pieces of, you know, stuff we'd find inside there Is that still the case, or are they shifting the way the benchmarks are done?
Yeah. So benchmarks, look, I've been a bit anti-benchmarks for a couple of years now. Did a talk about it actually in October 2024. We can link to that. And I have like a few blog posts to follow up on that I recently wrote. The problem with, what is it? The problem with measuring something is it like you kind of start tailoring the thing to the measurements.
Yeah.
And
especially if your livelihood is measured, connected to that.
Very true. And this brings up an interesting point. So one of the articles that we read together to prepare for this blog post is a kind of 2025 LLM roundup by Andre Kapathy. I've mentioned him before. He's a very prominent researcher in this area.
Deep thinker on this LLM stuff.
Very deep thinker. Very, like, kind of there from the beginning, really. So
yeah.
Kapathy talked about what he calls jagged intelligence. So it's the idea that LLMs do not kind of get better at everything in sequence, like not in sequence, but at the same time concurrently. So what this means is that benchmarks have always been a very problematic way of assessing performance, especially when you have these gestalt benchmarks that assess things like reasoning. Because they might be really good at math reasoning, you know, these sort of grade school math problem type reasoning, but they're not potentially very good at reasoning when it comes to medical diagnoses or reasoning in a legal context or other types of potentially different types of reasoning.
Yeah.
So it means that you can't necessarily like pull a model off the shelf that scored well on a reasoning benchmark and have it do well in all reasoning domains.
Right. Okay.
The other problem is that benchmarks have been gamed since benchmarks started being used. And sometimes it was accidental, like the data just sort of leaked into the training sets because it was in the public, like the benchmarks were public domain. That's something called data leakage in machine learning. Sometimes it's deliberate. There's something called, it's called like assessment overfitting, something like that. And it's basically the idea that you deliberately shape your tools, like your LLM, in order to succeed at the benchmarks. And there's definitely evidence that, say, the LM arena is being gamed like this. But this reinforcement learning from verifiable results has made everything so much worse, which Kapathy talks about in his article. And
can I mention an overfitting thing, just as an analogy again? Like when you think of like overfitting a data set and you look at like a visualization of it, it looks pretty spiky too, doesn't it?
Yeah. Like,
because you're like going directly to the point of this and this and so forth. And it's kind of a similar idea, I think.
And when you try and test this on fresh data, it's just not going to work. Like it won't work in the real world.
It doesn't even like, it's just like, it's totally just looking at an individual tree and not the forest at all.
Exactly. And, you know, if you think about benchmarks, they're kind of the ultimate form of verifiable feedback because they have an answer. That's why we use them, because they're very easy to automate.
Or
pattern matching, which is really good evidence that that's what LLMs do.
Right.
They don't necessarily reason per se, but they match patterns. And sometimes it can be done in a useful way. But if you push it too far, it gets brittle.
Right.
Yeah. By the way, this is a very fascinating kind of area called psychometrics, which is the...
Psychometrics.
The science of designing tests, which I studied during my degree. It's very cool and interesting. But yeah, that's a story for another time.
Could use a renaissance, it sounds like. Bring us back, please.
It's kind of the problem when you don't have like, what's the kind of like cross-field research?
Yeah. I don't know. People use the word liberal arts, this idea of like looking across everything and getting that sort of education as well. Like the reason you went to college was often the thing versus like going specifically for a certain science or what have you. But I don't know anymore. Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Do you want to touch on this one thing? He had this interesting line in his piece. I guess his piece was, you said at the end of the year, 2025 LLM year in review.
Mm.
He had this little thing talking about LLMs are not, some people think of them as evolving and that they're sort of animal-like, that you're like growing animals and they're learning, you're reinforcing things to like teach them how to do this. And it's like, oh, I taught them how to do that. And maybe as you like, maybe teach a child how to eat with a spoon or whatever was an example that he had. And he said, we're not evolving or growing animals. we are summoning ghosts. And I thought that was just amazing. And I'm like, it was so evocative because, like, yeah, I mean, they're training on, if you will, text, dead stuff that's out there. And then you're sort of like summoning the spirits of that information. It really brings that whole ghost in the machine kind of thing.
Yeah.
Of like, well, why is this doing that? And so forth. It's like these weird bits of information that are floating out there. I just thought it was very, very evocative. And I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Oh, I have opinions here. I won't derail the whole podcast. But I have a few talks where I've talked about like LLMs and intelligence.
Yeah.
What it kind of means to reach AGI and things like that.
Oh, so, yeah. Yeah, have you had a few of those?
Oh, gosh. that was quite a tear I had for about a year and a half.
Yeah.
The word that everyone forgets in AGI is general.
Yes.
General intelligence. And the reason we call it general intelligence in psychology is this idea that you as a human and other animals, of course, that can learn, you will see something that you are not trained to do, but it has enough perhaps abstract commonalities with something you are familiar with that you can generalize that knowledge and learn. And what Kapali is talking about with this jagged intelligence, with the animals versus ghosts, is we have these ghosts that are like sort of spikes in our brilliance in some areas.
Right. Which is so easy to fool people, like, oh my God, this thing is so intelligent and so smart. And it's like, well, it's got all that information from really smart ghosts.
Exactly. Or it's some area that it can train with verifiable rewards or like some other way of that we've learned how to teach it.
Right.
But again, it doesn't generalize because LLMs don't learn the way we do. We take our innate general intelligence and we kind of go top down and apply to skills. LLMs sort of go bottom up. Mm. They take this original dead text and they create this facsimile, this ghost of it that they can pattern match and apply. And again, it has utility, but it's why you can have an LLM that, I don't know, can sit with you and help you like digest scientific papers. It's something I use it for and it's quite useful.
Yeah.
Again, does hallucinate sometimes.
The summarization and combing through things and the automation part of that is just, I agree, extremely valuable. Exactly. Chef's kiss.
It's beautiful. Or it can help debug some like gnarly code or something.
Help you with the documenting.
Exactly. But it...
things you may not enjoy doing.
Thanks, yes. But then it'll fall for like the dumbest, most obvious prompt engineering attack. That's why. Because it's not an even general intelligence. It's these jagged spikes of brilliance, I guess could call it, and then these little pits of absolute stupidity, if you want to kind of like I really liked the way he talked about that, and it sort of I think helps people think about the benchmarking better, because a single number will never capture that, and helps people also understand like where we still have to go in order to make these generally useful. And I'm not saying generally intelligent. I don't believe in this term.
No, it's just at all time like having a level of skepticism, I think, is always helpful with all this sort of stuff. And so, yeah.
I agree. So to kind of round off what we're trying to say here, it's really, there's been questions about whether the model's getting better. And it's a bit hard to say because how do we measure it now?
Right.
The general gut feeling is that they are getting better. Like I'm talking about the LLMs themselves, but the gains are not what we saw a couple of years ago. Those days are done, even with post-training techniques. But what is getting better and what's really kind of interesting, and it's why I guess people are calling 2025 the year of the agent, is because the orchestration layers have become much more sophisticated and much more thoughtful. And now we're thinking about LLMs as pieces of software applications, like embedded inside this. And this is why you're hearing terms like context engineering and multi-agent systems and all this stuff. It's just thinking about how to architect an LLM to make it the most useful.
Can you just define context engineering? Like I think people can kind of get an idea of it, but the other one I've been hearing lately is like memory engineering, which is kind of, I think, related in a way, but I haven't heard anybody define context engineering.
Yeah, I suppose they called it this as a bit of a counterpoint to prompt engineering, because initially the idea was like prompt was everything. But there's been, like, to kind of demystify it a bit, there's been evidence since the very beginning of like when LLMs first started being used as generalist natural language processing models, that the more information you can provide about the problem you're trying to solve, the better the LLM would do. So the sort of early days of this was called meta-learning. It's really just providing examples of how it should solve this problem.
Then you had like this and that.
Yeah, and yeah, here's an explicit example, like, or a few explicit examples. So have you ever heard like one-shot learning or few-shot learning?
Okay.
This was what that was. Yeah, I know. This is the thing. They make it sound so complicated. It's really not.
Right.
Context engineering is really kind of a shift of, okay, let's take coding as an example, because I think coding agents has been one of the most successful things that we've seen. It's the difference between taking your code and pasting it into ChatGPT, and when you get that output, you know, ChatGPT can't see what's happening on your system, versus ChatGPT or whatever, like the LLM, being able to access the relevant context to solve that problem.
Okay.
So this is, again, it's not a terribly revolutionary idea, but it's the idea of passing the correct relevant information into the prompt as part of the prompt.
Okay.
Rather than just, here's the code, here's what I want you to do.
And this could be done through a variety of ways. Like that kind of goes back to a lot of the file-based stuff that I was mentioning before.
Mm-hmm.
Be akin to this, the spec-driven development, which I've had mm-hmm. a few conversations about.
Yep.
Again, I mentioned skills before, which is like Anthropic's term that's kind of becoming used by a lot of other people. And these sort of markdown files that then repeat things. The context windows keep getting potentially larger, depending on, you know, especially if you're working with like a cloud type of thing, you have this large amount of RAM that's available for it to kind of continue sort of thinking. And so being able to enter these elements in it, I think, is helping with that somewhat. You're giving it very, very specific stuff, as opposed to, like, again, the idea of like, used to be like, oh, I one-shotted this, you know, idea. And now I've like said, no, actually, I've set aside like this document that says this is stylistically how you're supposed to format things and control things. And
mm-hmm.
and then here's the design document that actually says like what the product is built and all the features that are needed and so forth. And somebody got mad because they were like, this is just going back to waterfall. And I was like, okay, well, so I brought that up to somebody else to, you know, say, well, is that really what's happening here? It's like, I mean, even with this iterative process that has happened in the world of engineering over the last bunch of years, there's always been a need for like documenting what we're doing and creating the designs. The fact that we meet and adjust those goals, I think, are still the same.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I'm too soon on this, but I definitely want to touch on this idea that eventually context that you're working with a particular agent
mm-hmm.
can get overwhelmed. Basically, the bigger, the more full it gets, the more it starts to fail.
Yep.
Which is just something that, you know, charts have been showing for quite a while as far as performance of these things.
Yep.
And so this idea of like, all right, we've discovered up to here, we've got the code that's been written so far, we have our design documents, we have these things that we can say, okay, refresh everything.
Mm-hmm.
Now look at it again. Is that the common pattern, or is this, am I kind of reading too much into it?
Yeah, like this is a super good point as well, because we're dealing with models. Models are as good as the data they're trained on and as good as the data that they predict on.
Yeah.
So data is always about signal. And if you just chuck, okay, let's say you're dealing with one of these coding agents. Let's say it's Claude Code. We can sort of talk about the specific ones soon. But if you chuck literally everything that's happening on your system into the context window, firstly, it's probably not going to fit. But
might not, yeah.
and let's say you chuck also your entire code base. How is it going to decide what is relevant and what isn't, when it's essentially completely overwhelmed with information? So it's actually like, I'm not here to advertise JetBrains. I work there, but like something very interesting that we did right from the beginning with JetBrains AI is the engineers recognize this.
Okay.
And again, obviously the context windows weren't as big. The models, you know, right. had a lot of load. Like we were kind of running out of compute as well, like back then even.
Yeah.
But because the IDE can see everything that's happening, the engineers basically built classifiers, like simple machine learning classifiers under the hood to try to predict what would be the most relevant context and pass only that in as part of the context window. Hmm. And, you know, it's sort of an early way of exploring this. Current applications are much more structured about how they treat different instructions and different pieces of information, but it's still the same idea. And it's the same idea with like any model. You pass in garbage, you're going to reduce the signal to noise ratio.
Yeah. I'm like a big video game person. And I was having this conversation with my wife. She's very much into video games too. And we play this game right now. It's called Aska. Mm-hmm. If you want a Viking-based survival game where you're also the HR director and team management person assigning jobs to all these people, it's pretty amazing. But they've been having some bugs lately because it has to hold the entire world in its head.
Mm.
What all the jobs these people are doing, what's the status of them, where it is, where everything's at, all the different things are being created and destroyed in the game and so forth. And so it's got this, you know, memory going. And then me, second user, joins this instance and now I'm doing things in the world and I'm out on these islands doing stuff and so forth. And I can see where the bugs start to happen. Like I see a person like suddenly like doesn't move anymore and you're like, oh no, we got a bug. And I thought about other games, you know, like, the idea of like a lot of large adventure games is, you know, in the world of, I don't know what they call them in Germany or Australia, but in Canada, they called them boards. I called them levels. You would basically, you know, you'd swap out, like you go into a cave and the outer world collapses and it basically creates this instance of us. Now we're working inside the cave. Mm-hmm. And as opposed to, you know, it remembers the things outside of there, but is it, I don't know, is it kind of like that? This idea that we can kind of like shift into memory what we're focused on right now instead of like trying to hold it all there? Is that kind of a technique?
So there are some techniques that I know about. So there is summarization, there is shifting into memory.
Okay.
But at its core, part of the problem is LLMs are just autoregressive loops.
Loops, yeah.
Yeah. So you don't necessarily have to keep the exact context, like the application designer can choose to wipe that context and summarize it or, you know, potentially break it up and shift part into memory if it's too old or whatever.
Okay.
But again, you're not dealing with anything more sophisticated than loops of text.
Right.
And so this is also where the flexibility comes in, but it's also where the frustrating part comes in when you're trying to design it to do precise things. And I found this when I was building the agent for that course. You know, React agents are the simplest type of agent. They're the most non-deterministic. It's very difficult to get predictable behavior when this is what you're doing. And this is why you can't just rely on the LLM to be intelligent enough, again, okay, to make all these decisions. You need to make some architecture decisions that may take away its decision power if that seems like a good idea.
Okay, like limiting its focus.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said before, people would give examples of what's happening in our newer framework we're thinking of right now. We're saying specifically the design pattern is like this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're building a database that has these features and these kinds of things. To me, it makes a lot of sense. The pattern I see a lot of people do with an agentic tool, I've seen a few people kind of doing this thing, is they'll have like a voice to text thing and they'll be talking to the agent.
Mm.
And what kind of baffles me often, and I kind of see like where like the token thing is going crazy lately, which we'll talk about later maybe,
mm-hmm,
is that, you know, they're having to speak this to the, you know, LLM and say, hey, or the agent and say, hey, I want this to happen, blah, 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 blah. And then it has to kind of go back and like read through everything it's sort of done up this point and then add that stuff on top of there.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, I can kind of see where it starts to maybe break down a little bit.
Yeah.
In that process. And also I can kind of see like, well, that's, you know, having a lot of it designed in your head in advance is just going to save so much, you know, as far as that goes. Of course, it depends on how you create and what you're writing, but I think that's really kind of interesting way approach. But I think that might be just a lot of how, you know, how people write software. They just sort of like stick stuff to the wall, you know, kind of.
Well, it's, I think like the original design of these applications can be like, you know, try React Agent, see how it goes.
Yeah.
But increasingly, like we already mentioned multi-agent systems.
Yes.
This is this idea that you will kind of pass part of the task to specific sub-agents that are specialized in doing specific things.
Okay.
And potentially they may be running off different LLMs to the like sort of conductor agent.
The tuned thing we were talking about.
Yeah.
Potentially, but maybe even it might be good to have... They're trained differently, so it's like having it's almost like having quote unquote diversity. It's like you have these other kind of things not only might they be good at, but also have different perspective.
Yeah, like it's more that like we talked about this in the last podcast because we've hit the wall on ultra generalist models.
Right.
These post training steps do force models into specializations. So reasoning models are not good at everything. They're good at some things, but they're quite bad at others.
Yeah.
So it might be that a smaller and simpler model, a model that focuses more on, say, simple translation tasks. Like for example, one of my tools, I use a different LLM in this course that I wrote. Because I didn't need a big beefy reasoning model.
Yeah.
I needed a model that could do translation quickly and accurately. So it's, again, it's classic ML principles. Use specialized models to do the task you want and optimize on those outcomes.
Everything old is new again.
Oh God. And please, AI is ML. Forget this. Yeah. You cannot escape the rules. Overfitting, data leakage, they're coming for you.
It's time to shine a spotlight on another RealPython video course. And I felt like this one fit the theme of this week's episode. In this age of LLM tools, you may want to provide relevant responses about topics that don't appear within training data. You can augment an LLM application using a vector database. A vector database allows you to store encoded unstructured objects like text as lists of numbers that you can compare to one another. You can add a collection of documents relevant to questions that you want the LLM to answer. And this course is titled Embeddings and Vector Databases with ChromaDB. It's based on a RealPython tutorial by Harrison Hoffman. And in the video course, Joseph Peart takes you through representing unstructured objects with vectors, using word and text embeddings in Python, harnessing the power of vector databases, encoding and querying over documents with ChromaDB, and how to provide context to LLMs like ChatGPT with ChromaDB. Like most of the video courses on RealPython, the course is broken into easily consumable sections, and you get code examples for the techniques shown. And all our courses have a transcript, including closed captions. And this course also includes our new code exercises, where you can practice the techniques as you progress through the course. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes, or you can find it using the search tool on realpython.com. But this is a term that we talked about just briefly before we started of ACP.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe we could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. And before we talk about ACP, maybe it might be better if I explain the sort of current generation of coding agents and then where ACP fits in.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of, we are a Python podcast, so we're always sort of focusing on, you know, creating tools and building things. But like, I definitely prompted you before we started this, that I am interested in using these tools to write code. And I think the majority of our audience is kind of geared toward that. So that makes sense.
Yeah. And maybe also a caveat. Again, we are moderates on this, so we'll talk a bit about, like, I think there's been a lot of hype about these agents. Again, I want to stress that they're tools. They're not.
Yes.
They're not replacing developers, but
yes, exactly.
Yeah. So, Claude Code was released in early-ish 2025, and Codex came soon after that. And my company actually had its own agent as well called Junie. So this was all sort of happening around the same time. But basically,
yeah, early springish 2025.
Yeah, exactly. What kind of changed with these was this idea of increasing context. And the way that Anthropic and OpenAI did it was they moved all of the processing to your local machine. So essentially, these run as desktop apps. They run in the terminal. This is why you use them as part of a CLI. And this means that, like, unlike, again, copying and pasting code into ChatGPT, they can get full access to rich context.
They can see your file system. They have a network. They have all those things.
Exactly. And then they built sort of additional things into this. So as well as having, like, sort of selective context use of this context engineering, they have architecture decisions, which do things like balance performance with speed and cost and things like that, although they can still be very, very expensive to use.
Yes.
They have sort of the ability for you to decide how much autonomy you want them to have, because they can use your system to execute code and run tests and do right. things like that.
There's a whole wild Moltbot and whatever kinds of things that are like the extension claw. Of where stuff is going now. The claws, I guess. We're not going there. But yeah, we can think of the this is where that stuff started, at least.
Yes, exactly.
Conceptually.
And I should also say, importantly, unlike OpenClaw, they have a strong stress of keeping humans in the loop, because the idea is they sort of do a limited number of actions.
Yeah.
The problem is solved. So the agent sort of completes its problem loop and then it comes back and says, hey, well, what do we do next? So these, like, I want to stress as well, this was not a result of model performance. The models, again, we don't necessarily know whether they've gotten drastically better. And the suspicion is really not. It's more that the way that they used, the context that's provided to them, the way that the architecture is structured has made them so much better in this specific domain, in coding. And it's cool. Like, I actually really like them. I find them useful for specific tasks. Again, I don't feel like it's going to put me out of a job. You know, I could lose my job for other reasons, hard economic times, but,
yes.
You know, I don't see them at the level of a developer or a data scientist. They're just very context-aware tools.
Yes, which is kind of a unique thing in our business. I mean, we already mentioned the things that we really like it being able to do of summarizing and being able to reference things and the sort of speed that they can kind of operate as far as finding things. It's always been baffling to me how bad the search tools are on a variety of things. So, the, you know, like Apple Mail is just horrific. You know, we at Real Python, we've used this piece of software that I won't name, but it can't do more than a word, a single word in search. And I'm like, what is, really? We're in 2026? And we had, hooked up an agent and now it does fine. And it can actually do multi, you know, things. It can quote unquote reason a bit about what it's looking through and so forth and provide suggestions. And it's like, yeah, this is much more like a quote unquote search engine.
Yep.
I'm intrigued by the idea that these sort of desktop apps, the term orchestration had always meant to me like deployment. But in a way, this is more orchestrating multiple agents.
Mm-hmm.
Again, could be instances of the same agent, but more than likely, as you work with it, you might start to find the ones that do these other things specifically. Or do they suggest to you? Like, that's the thing I think is kind of interesting. Like a curated example would be really nice. Like, oh, you should use this for this, will do this part of the job and so forth. Have you seen things like that or resources like that?
So what they tend to do under the hood is make those decisions. So different problems will require different levels of problem solving. So there's this concept like in reasoning generally, but it's been adopted by reasoning models, which is the idea of, it's got like fast versus deep reasoning. And so like a problem like 2 + 2 = 4, doesn't require deep reasoning, right? Whereas something like, I don't know, we need to find this bug. We need to then work out what happened with reference to these packages. Like, obviously, that's going to require a lot more problem decomposition and problem solving.
Find me the best path on a map from here to there or something.
Yeah. Exactly. So, again, this is something that my company was doing, like, from the start. You use these less powerful models or non-reason-focused models for these cheaper tasks. It's quicker, it costs less.
Okay.
And then you save the reasoning model for, like, the task that it needs to do. And this is part of how you design the application. Yeah.
I guess I'll take you back to ACP then.
Yeah, I think this is where we ended up back. So now you have agents, right? You have coding agents. The agents can do anything, right? The agent I build is for learning languages. Basically, you then might want to use these agents in an existing application. So you might want to use it in an IDE, for example. So this comes then to another kind of protocol other than the MCP called the ACP, the Agent Context Protocol.
Okay.
And again, it's a similar thing. It's just like the agent is able to plug in to the IDE or other applications, and you can essentially use it and offer up the context that the IDE has as part of the agent's context engineering workflow.
Okay.
So I've seen it likened to sort of LSPs.
Okay. That's the language server protocols.
Protocols, yeah.
Okay.
It's a similar context. Yeah, this was something that JetBrains developed in conjunction with Zed, because obviously we both had to solve the same problem.
Okay. I keep seeing Zed. I was not that familiar with it, but it's a, you know, it's an editor, right? It's not an IDE, or is it?
Yeah, it's...
I feel like it's kind of like one of these modern versions of, like, you know, the people that are into Vim and things like that. It's like not a pure terminal. It's an application.
Yeah, their kind of stance is they're very AI first.
Okay.
So perhaps lighter on the full-blown IDE features.
Okay. It's useful in this quote-unquote context for doing, like, this type of stuff. It's like got the wiring to do some of this.
Yeah, like, obviously I want to refrain from commenting on them because
right, you guys have other tools that you use. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, like, it's interesting. Yeah, but I mean that is an interesting angle. Like, I've talked to a variety of people over the years, you know, that are just text editor people or IDE people. And now there's this sort of hybridization of, like, well, I'm going to be using agents, and there's these applications by the companies we just mentioned, like Claude Code, which, you know, again, is using instances of these LLMs, and the same with Codex, and I haven't used Cursor, but, you know, similar, like, So MCP is this tool for kind of API-like things, like giving you instructions on how to talk to other services and send stuff back and forth. And I don't know if I already mentioned this, but one of the things that I think is weird is the idea that they were just overblown, right? This, they would have a little too much instructions on what they're sending sometimes, and maybe there's a way to kind of narrow that focus. But ACP is then, if I'm going to give information about, I'm going to give this part of the job to you, hey, to do this thing. I don't know. I'm trying to think of examples, like, okay, hey, I want you to help me create the tests for something I've built.
Perfect example. Yeah.
Okay.
So it could be, here is essentially, well, it's a bit hard too, because you shouldn't necessarily let LLMs write tests for code that they wrote. Yeah, because it'll just justify its own bad decisions and good decisions, right?
Okay.
But let's say you wrote the code.
Right.
And so now you fully understand this code and would be a perfect use case to hand over to an agent, a coding agent.
Okay.
Or,
I know the GitHub stuff is like a common thing, like being able to pull things and push things and that sort of stuff.
Or, let's say you've got the PR in the IDE and you say to the agent, hey, my colleague committed like 10,000 changes. Can you maybe summarize they actually, like, I love using LLMs for, like, machine translation, like translating from code to human. Or my husband used Claude Code, for example, to find this kind of gnarly bug, because it was able to kind of scan the code base And it was quite an obscure thing because it was something to do with like a cloud distribution, and they're always a bit hard to debug.
Okay.
And yeah, I think it found like a just this weird thing in the config file, which he wouldn't have thought to look for. So, and you know, sometimes it doesn't work. Like sometimes you're going around in circles and banging your head because it just doesn't have the correct context or whatever.
Okay.
But sometimes it's a real time saver.
So ACP is like letting you connect these different things together, right?
Exactly. Like otherwise you'd essentially have to have Claude code built into the IDE.
Okay.
But yeah, then you can just communicate with the agent, hand over the tasks and have it have access to the context.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
So it's a weird time.
Tell me that.
As far as this stuff goes in the world of the AI hype, if you will, is still out there. It's been kind of going on for quite a while. And at the same time, there's this kind of weird, like, I what is the term I used? It's called cognitive dissonance, this idea of like having two opposing ideas in your brain at the same time. And there's like a lot of people that are, I mean, literally just happened today or yesterday when we record this, of 30,000 engineers of being let go of these major corporations. Oh, why AI is going to take their jobs?
Yeah.
And it's like not really true per se, but also at the same time, like there's this thing that you need to start embracing AI, you need to enjoy it, and it should be in all parts of your life and so forth, and it's going to take your job. And it's like this cognitive dissonance, like, oh, I should love this thing that's going to get rid of my livelihood. It's like, don't you remember that idea of like making sure things are good for my livelihood? Anyway.
Exactly. And I think it's, look, this is my first like tech hype bubble. Like I was too young for the dot-com bubble.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
I was not in programming at the time when we had this discourse a few times with Mr. Trudeau is definitely on that side, curmudgeonly. Yeah.
A friend of mine has gone through it before as well. Doesn't feel great being in this time. I think I just want to reassure people, and I've already said it, like there's this kind of, I don't know, feeling that these coding agents are so good now, they're going to replace developers. And there is no real evidence of this so far. And if you kind of want to hear more about like the economic relationship between AI, job layoffs, et cetera, like the market conditions, we talked about this quite a lot in the last podcast that we did together.
Yeah.
Like there's kind of no real evidence that people can vibe code things that are sophisticated production systems without expertise. So kind of where it leaves us is, and this is something I've been saying for a while, it means that the sort of deep expertise that you have as a developer, these kind of like really core skills about architecture decisions, system design, quality judgment, things like this.
Right. Things that you don't always learn in school, but you develop in your professional career as you're working with people.
Yeah.
And talk to the other people that have requirements and desires and so forth.
And see good and bad systems and yes, build them yourself. Yeah. You know, this is the sort of stuff that the job is now moving towards because creating the code is becoming cheap.
Right.
Now, the flip side of that is a friend of mine, Laura Summers at Pydantic, she wrote this very nice blog post called "The Human in the Loop is Tired."
Yeah.
And it sort of talks about like the way that the job now has sort of switched to debugging and refactoring this code and like looking out for security holes. And
I have a whole thing on this. Yeah, my thing is that you can make so much code so fast, and all these people are so excited. I've created so much code, and it reminds me of like listening to interviews or watching people who were making movies in the 70s and so forth, and they're like, everybody's on cocaine. And this coding agent thing is like that. It's like, I could create so much. I've made so much. Blah, blah, blah. And then they go, I am so tired. Well, why are you so tired? I'm still responsible for all this code. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. You made a whole bunch of babies here and you need to still care and feeding of all of them. And you're like, crazed, you know, run that you just had. It's like, so, you know, like we had a whole thing a couple of weeks ago about reading your code, like, you know, and mm-hmm. being able to skill of review. And now there's just so much more of it. And that feeling of responsibility is why you're tired. I mean, if you're a good person.
and it's also as well, like, frankly, for me, the fun comes from like solving the problem, right?
Oh, that is me, yes.
Yeah, and like this bigger kind of solving the problem, like solving the architecture and things like that. But there's also those small moments of writing the code that solved a little puzzle.
Sure.
And you get a little dopamine hit. Yeah. And then you understand that code because you wrote it and you were testing it as you go, as you're getting that rewarding process. I think we need to kind of look out for the fact that are we robbing the job of all the fun at the same time that we're now being told we should be 10 times more productive because we have this tool.
Right.
But we feel less motivated maybe than ever to do the job because we're kind of doing the bits that are not...
the fun part and not as fun.
They're not as fun, yeah. Yeah.
And it's like so, having a robot to do all the puzzles on your thing. Look what it did. And then you have to check the puzzles. Yeah, you're going to hang that on the wall.
Exactly. So
good job, Chatty G.
You did it.
Yeah.
Good work, little Claudie. But then, you know, like it also taps into like wider discussions that people are having about like, what's happening to open source now? They're getting slammed with all of these LLM contributions. You know, and like, I don't want to get down this rabbit hole. And
There's a lot of disservice there.
Yeah. But we hosted a conference a couple of weeks ago where we had a panel and a talk about this, like the role of open source, LLMs in open source. And also my friend Lais, also from Pydantic, hosted a panel with Guido van Rossum and a few other very prominent people in Python, again, about the same topic. So plenty of stuff out there if you want to get into that.
Yeah, we won't. Yeah, the jazz band announcement is another one. Yeah. Maybe you saw that, Yeah, it's a weird time for that. And I agree that, you know, hopefully it's just something that the, you know, the hangover will pass and we can kind of get kind of grounded again, but the tool is here, you know, the drugs are here to go fast if we really want to, but the idea is like a sort of a balancing thing of like, you know, where does it fit in and is this maintainable, you know, and keeping that eye on that focus there.
Like how do we turn it from cocaine to Adderall?
Or something, yeah. Some prescribed amounts of whatever.
Yeah, rather than something that just burns us out and robs the field of its joy.
Yeah.
But yeah, I kind of want to round out our discussion because yet again, we've gone over an hour. But
yeah,
kind of coming back to this idea of like, what's the future? So the tools are here to stay. The models are here to stay. They are very helpful at times and, you know, we're getting a lot of benefit from these orchestration layers, but this leads to a very interesting consequence, which is the focus really now is not on necessarily training the hugest and best and next greatest model. It's maybe actually training smaller models or using older models because we can squeeze a lot of performance out of them with the right context. And of course, this means like older, you know, huge generalist models. But actually, very interestingly, we're now seeing that smaller open source models are as performant in the right context with the right orchestration layers as these huge generalist models. So we're seeing, again, more move towards verticals, more move towards smaller language models, and more move towards like carving out the problem space and not having just one app to solve them all. And I think you shared this very interesting video from Rick Beato where he was talking about local models and...
Yeah, he's a music guy. If people are not familiar with Rick Beato, he's, you know, white-haired, you know, music dude. So that's why I follow him. See the guitars and stuff behind me. But anyway, he's a very interesting guy and he's had a few different people to talk on a little bit about the AI music generative thing, which I'm, you know, just really upset me over the last couple of years. And I'm sure the same feeling that artists have and the people that work in movies and so forth are having the same kind of like, creative kind of things. But what's funny is that, you know, he had a conversation about some of that where he asked other people, have you played with these tools? Yes, I have. Mm-hmm. Have you touched them? I haven't touched them in 9 months. And it's, and I think it's, that's kind of the way the art thing is too, a little bit, and maybe the video thing. And it's like, wow, this is really intriguing and interesting. It's cool to have a robot do my entire puzzle, you know, or whatever. It's just that you can, yes, it is a fascinating party trick, and maybe we can laugh about it or whatever. We can make a funny song, and but is it something you want to consume and use and so forth? So that's one conversation that he had that I think is really fascinating. You can see him talk about it on his channel. But at the same time, he thought about, well, what's coming for these large AI companies? And unfortunately, the models, like we said, there's a certain size that seems to work for doing certain jobs and certain things that he wants. And he's like, it's like the music industry in the sense that computers are coming for it too. Mm. I would always say this, you know, I worked through the late 90s into the 2000s at a school for recording engineers. And I would say to them, you need to learn computers. And they'd look at me, and there literally was like a division between analog and digital. And, you know, it seems like ancient times, but this was, you know, literally I was like showing people floppy diskettes and, you know, stuff like that at the time. And trying to explain to them, hey, you need to understand file systems. You need to understand how to do this. You need to, you know, label stuff. And you definitely need to learn this thing called Pro Tools, because I'm sorry, but like I've seen what happened to print. You know, print doesn't use these machines. Nobody's sitting there and laying out type anymore. They're using computers for it, for magazines and so forth. And the music industry is kind of like, it's kind of like print, photography, audio, and then movies. And basically each one of those industries kind of getting taken over by the digitalization of them and so forth, and kind of living through it. And he, you know, he talked about, you know, these studios had $700,000 consoles that they had to pay rent for, and the, you know, the electricity and so forth. And meanwhile, you know, Billie Eilish and her brother are in their bedroom making platinum albums. And that's just basically the facts that you can do this. Computerization has happened. Mm. Is that going to happen for AI? Mm. And so he's, you know, again, this older dude, but he's interested. He's like me, he's fascinated by what's happening in the world. He said, yeah, so I downloaded LM Studio, which is a way I can run local models. And this person said, okay, download this particular model. And then he got it offline and then started asking it chat questions, the type of questions that, you know, like an average person would for ChatGPT, like plan this trip for me and, you know, tell me about, you know, this or whatever. And I did something similar yesterday. I, you know, had it like do kind of like a read through of several paragraphs and say, well, is there a better way that you could rephrase this? And these local models are completely capable of doing this. I don't have a super powerful machine. He probably has a more powerful Mac than I did. Mine has like 24 gigs of RAM, which isn't a lot in this world. What he was saying is like the needs of the typical user for a chatbot, this idea of like having, I don't know, somebody to talk to or what have you, like even in the examples I gave of the writing thing, it was even being overly saccharine, sweet and nice. And, oh, that's amazing and so forth. And anyway, I want to find models that definitely don't do that if I can, but it's sort of surprising, you know, all the hallmarks are there, but I was able to like go and grab specific ones for coding. And I had it make a little CLI application for me. And it's kind of cool because you can see the context window down there on the bottom. You can see like as it's using it up, like what's available and so forth. You know, but like the idea of this shift of this industry spending all this money on these massive, massive, massive data centers. There's a couple other things I'll link to. There's this guy who's sort of a finance consultant, investor, researcher. His name's Paul Kudrowski, and he's been on the show Plain English a bunch. And they were like, well, you know, what's happening? There's the idea of a bubble, right? Mm-hmm. And so forth. And he's like, yes. And why is it not like other bubbles? Well, people keep saying, well, it's like the railroads. And then he's like, has to go back historically and say, well, the railroads caused a whole bunch of crashes too, if you weren't familiar with this and do your historical research. But in the end, the railroads left metal and wood, and the pathways were there. And the same thing happened with the 2000s internet boom. They laid all this fiber that was dark fiber, unused after the crash in the 2000. But then Netflix came along and these other uses came along. They started lighting up, if you will, the railways of the internet. And And everybody's like, well, the data centers are going to be that. And it's like, well, the data centers are different. They're based upon GPUs and this sort of like stuff that will expire, you know, like what's the lifetime of a GPU? And that's more than half the price of what the building is, let alone the whole energy thing and the other stuff. I don't even get into the whole ethical concerns because that's a whole thing that we could spend another time on, but not necessarily Python centric. But in the end, it's like, okay, you are building some infrastructure, but is this this long-lasting infrastructure that's going to be used across all time? And I just don't know if it is. And the investment is questionable, and things are as wobbly as I've ever seen them, especially if you watch, unfortunately, OpenAI's announcements of late. So, yeah, could you do a lot of these things on a local model, potentially? And coding? I think so.
Yeah.
To a point, depending on what you're trying to do, the idea of lots of things that we've mentioned too, that, you know, we've had these tools for linting, we've had these tools for formatting code. We potentially have tools that can help us with documentation, which again is something that is about as fun as linting potentially, you know, for depending on the person. And then they'd be able to revoice them in a human way to make it much more readable and enjoyable. You can definitely tell what documentation somebody spent time working on and ones that, you know, literally just read like a specification page. And so I think it's really interesting time for that stuff. And I'm exploring it more and more, you know, the models that are specific like Quencoder and DevStrel. And I mentioned a Wagtail post recently with them saying, what are their models that they're trying out and what are they doing locally? And they had some interesting suggestions. And there's even like a tool where you can like compare their answers. And that's an interesting thing. It's sort of a benchmark of your own then to kind of see how they perform against each other. So there are these harnesses that you can kind of set things up and let them race a little bit and try them out. But yeah, I agree that, you know, this is a bit of a bubble. It's been an exuberant period. There's weird cognitive dissonant messages being sent out there. There's a lot of layoffs happening that they're blaming on AI, which are truly not. And somehow they make the stock go up, which to me is the dumbest thing ever, because anybody who's laying off people, they're not doing well.
No.
They're just not. I'm sorry. That there's no proof that you're doing well if you're laying off. That there's like, that's again cognitively dissonant.
Yeah.
And you can explain it however you want. But so anyway, things to pay attention to. So I think the local thing is definitely something I want to keep watching over the next year or so. I haven't bought like a massive computer for it, but again, the tasks that I'm doing are smaller. You know, most of the work I do is for myself, or I'm starting to do more and more work for small businesses again in designing tools for them. And they're just not these overarching things. The whole, I don't know if you heard about the SaaS apocalypse that some people were worried about.
Yeah. Like,
oh no, skills files are going to basically make it so you don't need doctors or, you know, lawyers or whatever. And I'm like, you guys are extrapolating so much.
Yeah.
I think it's helpful, you know, like anything to make that stuff be better. Like I'm kind of tired of hearing about lawyers like citing stuff that just isn't
actual. They keep getting like, sprung law. With this, like the precedence that just dreams up.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. So, but anyway, that's my two cents on it. I think Rick's video is good. I'll put a link to it. It's just a perspective, you know, and I think that perspective is kind of shown itself that, yeah, you know, like your local computer is just going to get more powerful and they keep tuning them to be good at this stuff. And I think for privacy reasons, that is a huge one, especially for companies too. The idea of like running instances locally, there's lots of reasons that you may want to look at this.
I think it's also like, it's an exciting kind of thing to think about as well. Like for me, this sort of shift to thinking about the architecture of agentic applications, like really leads to, you know, a lot of possibilities that you may have these like highly vertical applications focused on very specific things, and they can use potentially multiple different LLMs for different tasks. It kind of, I think, helps remove this really, like, again, I love LLMs. I know it doesn't seem like it, but I do.
Right.
This wonderful technology.
It's such a cool progression of all the things that we've talked about in all of our conversations over the years.
Like, it kind of divorces them from all of this scary economic stuff that we hear and all the uncertainty around the
right.
the business side of it, and kind of gives some hope that actually there's going to be some potentially really cool applications and technology that come out of this in the coming years.
Yeah. I mean, look at like what they've done with visual learning or what do you want to call it? That kind of stuff, that these were terms that were, again, AI of their time.
Yeah.
This ability to do these sorts of tasks, and they became focused tools mm-hmm. and got different names and became ML or whatever it is, you know? Just the whole text-to-speech stuff has just been crazy, and vice versa.
Yeah, like I was reviewing applications for EuroPython this year, and I saw people using like vision text models, like multimodal models for things like helping people who are visually impaired. Like,
that's the one thing I keep seeing with like the Meta Ray-Ban thing, which again, a lot of people are like, if I see you come into the bar with them, I'm going to smack them off your face. But like, if it's a vision impaired person, and there was a story that I listened to about people talking about it, and it's like, it's been incredible for their life, you know, like that it can do, it can recognize things and potentially read things for them and so forth. And we just don't think about that. And it's like, well, yeah, but it's not marketed as that. And it's rare. Like the people that are best at that are Apple. Like they're bananas about the health stuff. Mm-hmm. Like they're like, oh, we've saved all these people's lives and so forth. But Meta, I think is maybe allergic to that type of like humanitarian thing because they've been such bad actors over time. Anyway, just generally speaking, I'm not talking about engineers and stuff again, but it's just, it's kind of weird. There are these uses that I think are great and amazing. And it's like, it's nice to highlight them, but it's also nice to also like put a couple additional sandbags on that balloon to like make sure it's not getting overly inflated.
And maybe if anyone wants some context, I think I might have mentioned it in the last blog post, but I gave a keynote last year which was about the history of AI summers and winters and where our current one fits in. The thing is, like, winters don't kill off progress. It's actually like when the exciting work happens. So like, I think we are in a bubble. I think this is unsustainable economically, but the technology will stick around. And I think that the really exciting work is going to start soon.
Yeah.
Once we stop focusing on AGI and give up on that.
Yeah, I think I could agree. Yeah, I mean, the pivot has already happened. I think it even was happening when we were talking.
Yeah.
Those three letters are being used less and less.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed talking to you about this stuff, like the jagged intelligence ghosts versus animals thing. I think is really kind of a cool way to kind of think about some of these things. The focusing of the models, you know, I continue to think about ways to you know, review this stuff of like, well, how can you use this? Because I agree that this is an interesting direction we're headed. So thanks again for coming on and sharing all this stuff. Maybe I could tie up with one last thing. You're doing some stuff for EuroPython.
Yes.
When is that and where is that? Yes. And
Oh, actually, the next conference I'll be at is PyCon US.
Okay.
So I'm going this year. So if you...
You'd be down there in Long Beach.
In California. So if you want to come say hi, I'll be there with the JetBrains booth. I'm not doing a talk this year. And I will be at EuroPython, which will be... I think it starts... I can't remember. It's mid-July in beautiful Krakow.
Okay.
Krakow is amazing. So, and it's going to be such nice weather. I hope.
Yeah.
Should be.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I'll definitely include all the links for that stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm probably going to talk to some organizers from EuroPython coming up. So that might come back again.
Yay.
I know you're involved in that somewhat too. You said you were reviewing proposals. That's done, right? We're done.
Yeah. I just... like very, very light involvement this year. I cannot claim to be organizing. So, but yeah, my friends on the program team have put together a beautiful schedule. So
yeah, cool. Awesome. I got to make it over to Europe to do one of these things.
Yes.
Ireland was amazing last year. It was really great running into all these people and listeners of the show. That was really fun.
PyCon is dope, man.
Yeah.
You can come. We should come.
All right. Well, Jody, it's always fun to talk to you. Thanks for coming on the show.
Always a pleasure. And till next time.
Yeah, definitely. I want to thank Jody Burchell for coming on the show again this week. And I want to thank you for listening. If you like the episode, a great way to help us grow our audience is to share it with other Python users who you think might enjoy it. You can also leave a rating or a review on your podcast platform of choice. If you or your company are interested in sponsoring the podcast, you can find all the information at realpython.com/advertise. You can find show notes with links to the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.